In a weak moment, when somebody asked me if I was going to do something here, I said, yes, I'll do something. And what I'm going to do is to give you some of my views on vocation, or calling, as I prefer to call it. And I'm doing this because I did something like this in Alaska at the end of October at an Alaska conference. And there was a very poor tape of it, due mainly to the speaker. And so this is a second chance, only I hope I've tried to improve it a bit. And this is my way of answering these people who want a tape of it. And I figured Holden just as well make some money on it. So I should also point out that just before I went to Alaska for this conference, I had just come back from Beto, visiting Beto. And so it was very fresh in my mind. So tonight, as in Alaska, I will be referring to many of my experiences and my knowledge of Beto to make certain points. Before I do that, let us open with prayer. Bless, O Lord, all thy beasts and singing birds, and guard with tenderness small things that have no words. And in thy mercy, Lord, give us tender hearts towards all those to whom this day brings less joy than it brings to us. Those in whom the pulse of life grows weak, those who must lie in bed every day, the blind who are shut out from the light of day, the deaf who miss the sounds of voice and song, the overworked who have no joy of leisure, the unemployed who have no joy of labor, those who grieve, whose hearts and homes are desolate. Grant thy mercy on them all. And we do rejoice in the memory of those we love and who are no longer with us. We rejoice because we know that although they have passed into mystery, they have not passed beyond your love and care. And thank you for the mere joy of living, for all the sights and sounds around us, for work to perform and the ability and opportunity and strength to perform it, for time to play and sing, for health and a glad heart to enjoy it. Bless all those here tonight. We commit them all to your tender care and keeping. Amen. What should I go into? What field shall I enter? What should I study? These are questions that I'm probably asked as an educator more than any other question. People are searching for answers to these questions. And they are important questions. They are very important indeed. I would prefer to address it under the title of our calling rather than vocation, although some people relate them as synonymous. But the concept of the call came out, I believe, out of the Reformation, and Martin Luther had a good deal to say about it. Some writers consider him the chief architect and promoter of the concept of the call, or calling as we have come to know it in more recent times. Vocation in recent times stressed science, engineering, and business. Recent emphasis has been on nature, environment, and on animals. Children are introduced into these subjects very early. They know much more about motor cars than mankind, more about Hondas than human beings. We do not know how to handle ourselves, our children, our relatives, our neighbors, the old people, the disabled, and that includes all of us to some extent, and the unfortunate among us. We have relegated this to somebody else, chiefly to institutions of the state. The system of welfare organizations supported by the state and others are increasing at a fantastic rate. They are created to repair the damage done to people suffering from wrong upbringing, poor nutrition and care, harmful pleasures, misguided and hazardous recreation. Impersonal councils far removed from the scenes of action are called on more and more to deal with matters formerly handled by parents, grandparents, other relatives, good friends and neighbors. Grandparents are now pretty much out of it. They're in old people's homes. There is no contact or little contact with neighbors. And as a aside, many people have, on finding out that I'm a veterinarian, accused me of sort of a cop-out, an escape, because animals are easier to deal with than people. Some of them are also more lovable on occasion. But God got even with me because he has now placed me in a position where I have to deal with far more people than I have animals to deal with. And I'm here to tell you it's very difficult. Before I, however, begin to talk about the heavy subject of the call, and it is a heavy subject, a la Luther, I would recall for you a verse of scripture that Bodil Schwenk used to explain Beto. A brief history of Beto, a person in southern France in 1865 worked with epileptics. He wrote a letter to some people in Germany and told them that they ought to also take care of the epileptics there instead of hiding them in attics and back rooms. And so a merchant in Bielefeld bought a farm, obtained help. They took in, it started with four epileptics in about 1867. And they called Pastor Old Father Bodil Schwenk, who was a real genius, in 1872. He had been in a parish in Westphalia. Before this, he had been in Paris, France, ministering to the Germans, because the Germans were brought to Paris in those days to clean up after the Frenchmen. They did the dirty work. And so he was there to minister to them. While he was in a parish in Westphalia, and just before he got the call to Beto, four of his four children died with diphtheria in a matter of 10 days. He lost them all. And this probably introduced him and gave him compassion to deal with those who were going to come to Beto, for whom he would care for in a most remarkable way. It is also interesting to note that he obtained a letter from a fellow pastor who was at some distance away when he lost all four children. And this pastor said to him, God will replace them. And after a short time in Beto, Pastor Bodil Schwenk, who was then director, was called on one day, unannounced, by this pastor who he hadn't seen in a long time, who had written him this letter when he lost his four children. And it is very unusual to realize that this pastor did show up on the day that his fourth child, a son, Pastor Fritz Bodil Schwenk, was born. He had already three sisters before him. This was the fourth child that this pastor told him would be replaced. Pastor Fritz Bodil Schwenk was the genius who took over Beto in 1910 and held that position until his death in 1946 through two world wars. And this pastor, Fritz Bodil Schwenk, otherwise known as just Pastor Fritz, used as a text to explain Bethel, which means it's Bethel, the city of God. He used this verse. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High, from Psalm 46:4. Pastor Fritz used this psalm then to really explain the city of God. The city of God has three special characteristics, says this psalm. It is fed by God's stream, adorned by God's holy tabernacles, and protected by God's walls. I should break in, though, however, to say that in Beto, unlike many institutions like that, there are no walls. That's by design. They have no walls. And each of their settings now, which includes many, many places, some branches even in East Germany, which I didn't visit. I only visited a few of them. But at every place that they have a headquarters, there is always an open door and somebody to welcome anyone who needs help. Now, this characterizes Betel. It should characterize each congregation, these three things. It should characterize each one of us here tonight as we work to relieve misery, need, and darkness of every kind. For misery and suffering relieved by God are transformed into divine joy. Every father is called to be a priest in his house. Every mother is called to be a spiritual guide for the children. The sick and dying and those in need in the neighborhood are surrounded by walls of intercession and supported by hands of faith. We must resist being swallowed up in business, but God can only dwell in our homes if we may have made room for him in our hearts, as our own Pastor Fritz pointed out to us on Christmas. Then we move from complaining to inward quietness, from quietness to thanksgiving, from thanksgiving to hope and praise, and also gladness will be then our trademark as tabernacles of God, surrounded by God's wall and fed by his streams, come to us. And my wish and prayer for each of you here tonight is that the spirit and reality I witnessed at Betel will be manifest in the days and years ahead in you and your congregations in your community as you pursue your calling. And the other thing, the other incident that I wish to recall at this point from Betel addresses the very important component of the calling, which has to do with sensitivity and concern. And this is so important because there is so much insensitivity and unconcern today. Our failure to show mercy too often characterizes our generation. We're so involved with other things. In my business, I see how many people are more concerned with animals than they are with people. And it's perhaps understandable, because on television, even the rabbits are smarter than people. Or people are shown as terrible people who mistreat animals. And I could go on and on to tell you about some of the crazy things that I see relative to this insensitivity to people. Many people just look at other people as being no damn good. And that's much of the philosophy today. This insensitivity, it's like vice in Christopher Pope's poem on where he says, "A monster of such evil mien as to be hated needs but to be seen. But seen too oft, familiar with her face, you first endure, then pity, then embrace." It was one day at Betel in one of their very beautiful and modern kindergartens, which are organized in a fantastic way, which I won't go into here. But out in the play area one day, the kindergarten was playing and one of the children came running into the teacher's room near this play area and he was crying. And he said, "Auntie, I don't want to be the priest any longer." "Well, what do you want to be then?" she asked. "Oh," he said, "I'd like to be the Samaritan or the donkey or one who fell among thieves." The teacher was at first puzzled by this until she went outside and saw the reason for the boy's tears. And then she recalled that a few days before she had told the children about the parable of the Good Samaritan. And there before her was a little boy stripped to his waist, lying on the floor, his eyes closed. Another child was knelt over him, tapping his chest and his neck and about any place else he could find, pouring oil on his wounds. A third child, a boy, was on all fours. Obviously he was the donkey. And the thieves, looking very guilty, were in the far corner of the playground. And another group of children were the inn. They were holding hands, and inside was the innkeeper. And then the injured child was draped over the donkey, and with great, very great effort, the donkey carried the little boy to the inn. And witnessing this scene was this little lad who was condemned to play the part of the priest. He didn't want to play the priest anymore. And he's right. It's a difficult, thankful vocation if you have any sensitivity and concern. This being the priest and the Levite in the Good Samaritan story these days is difficult indeed, for you'd have to then be able to turn your eyes away from human misery. And it's really difficult if you really understand the meaning of the call. It's a lonely, miserable life. It's a sad life if there's no love and concern, and it's worthless. He shall have judgment without mercy that hath shewed no mercy. This discussion on calling by necessity starts out really sort of heavy. Calling by many is thought of as synonymous with vocation, as I said earlier, or work, profession, or trade. But those of you who believe that will hopefully have your mind changed. Calling connotes far more than this. Every day of our life we face a whole series of duties which lie outside of our vocation, our work, and our profession. But these tasks belong to the very heart of our calling. For of a truth, one can be unusually conscientious and productive worker, yet violate the most elementary requirements of faithfulness to one's calling. It should be of interest to you that in Luther's view of calling, the two thoughts, calling and earthly obligation of vocation and work, are inseparably united, while in many religions, and also in the Romance languages, there has been a constant and continuing strife between the two. Many of us have not been immune to this strife and conflict in our own life and in our church. In earlier days before the Reformation, and in many places continuing until now, the higher calling involved God's work, and it was characterized by the absence of labor as we know it. That is, work with your hands was considered profane. It was a lower calling. When Luther was writing the explanation to the third article, he used these words: "I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength believe in Jesus Christ my Lord or come to him, but the Holy Spirit has called me through the gospel, enlightened me by his gifts, and sanctified and preserved me in the true faith." The call is here confronting us with holy words, words like enlightenment and sanctification. You can well say this word call has two meanings. I believe that Luther more than most realized that just as certainly as the call to God's kingdom seeks to lift us up out of our workaday world, just as certainly the call does not take us away from these duties, but more deeply into them. In Luther's idea of calling, the two thoughts, God's calling and the earthly obligation of vocation and work and labor, are inseparably united. This concept was really newly revealed at the time of the Reformation, mainly because St. Paul had not been fully understood, I believe. Luther came at it in perhaps somewhat indirect way. To Luther, God's great love to us was manifested in the forgiveness of sins. This to him was the heart of everything. To Luther, this forgiveness of sins was the core. In this he found his theory of the sacraments, his idea of the church, his doctrine of Christian liberty, and his teaching of the call. He found them all in the forgiveness of sins. And this call is gospel, not law, because we can't respond rightly by our own reason or strength. To Luther, the church is the forgiveness of sins. The sacraments are the forgiveness of sins. Liberty is the forgiveness of sins. And the call is the forgiveness of sins. And it's timely also for this season, for only in the last few days we read together Matthew 1:21, when the angel visits Joseph and says, She will bear a son, and you shall give him the name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Now, as you analyze this, you can say, well, they could have called him judge because we want justice. Or we could call him general because many of the Jews wanted a Messiah that would overcome the enemy. Or they could have called him physician so he could heal all their disabilities. Many of them wanted a banker who would buy them what they wanted. Many wanted a farmer. They could have called him farmer so he could raise all the food that they needed and nobody would go hungry. But most significantly, they needed a savior, someone who would save them from their sins. And at this point, I turn to something that Al Rognes said or wrote. The message of God's forgiveness is the most profound word given to man. It takes man's plight very seriously. At the same time, it takes the incredible dimension of God's love seriously. All of creation may speak of a gracious God, but it is in the cross alone that God's love breaks through with unmistakable brilliance. Here he forgives the sinner and he turns him to his brother and his sister, to himself and to God. Alienation and estrangement are gone. Man is at one again with God and all of creation. The noteworthy thing about people, even a Christian, is not that they are loving and forgiving, for we all fall short on performance. The noteworthy thing is that we are the loved one, the forgiven one. That is the word of the gospel. That is the heart of vocation, of our calling. To Luther, the call was not primarily a duty, but a gift. Only secondarily to him was it duty. Now, some of you might not look at that like that, especially if you're Mike and you're out here in the snow, 50 degrees below miserable, trying to put a chain back on a snowmobile. Or you on the dish cruise, or especially if you're Omar in pots and pans this week. Or if you're on garbage detail and it's 70 degrees below miserable here. In your menial tasks, you have God and his great love. To Luther, negligence to a call was above all else unthankfulness. To Luther, faithfulness in a call was synonymous with faith in God. We must rely on God and not ourselves. In this regard, he did not inspire zeal to the call by referring to great cultural achievements, but chose the most humble work. To Luther, it was a part of the glory of the deeds of one's calling that these are humble enough to ward off the temptation to seek one's joy in what one does, and only in that. At this point, I will, to really stress this point of the servant nature, I remind you that God is always turning the tables on us. Between servant and master. The reason I went to Bielefeld is that I was already in Europe in a way, and I'd always wanted to go there. I was in Europe to participate and to speak, to give a series of speeches at the European Armed Forces Conference for the Health Sciences in Garmisch. And it was an assembly of probably 1,000 people in this theater at Garmisch, and we were waiting then for the start of the ceremony. And then when General Evans, who is commander of air forces in Europe, along with General Schaefer, who is the Surgeon General of the United States Air Force and to whom I consult, and for my reason being there, as they walked in, everybody stood up. A few weeks later, our Governor Dixie Lee Ray, here in the state of Washington, came to Washington State University. She came into a meeting, and when she came in, everybody stood up. in January at the Washington Hilton, at the President's Prayer Breakfast. I guess there must have been 3,000 of us there. And when President Carter came in, everybody stood up. Now, when a servant enters, they come in unnoticed, unannounced, and no one even inquires about their name. It's different with God. The servant tops the list. People were created to be servants. When God came to earth, he came as a servant. And for you who have seen the movie, Oh God, which I recommend very highly, and if you haven't seen it, you will note that God always appears in that movie as a servant. In God's plan, the president and the governor serve the people. The general serves the soldier. The owner serves the worker. And the powerful and the strong serve the weak. And so it is at Bethel. To whom much is given, much will be required. And Martin Luther took some time, but he finally understood this. Most people have never learned this. Martin Luther said to his people, and he says to us today, love thou God in his creatures. By these words, Brother Martin wanted to not only encourage us to serve people, but to impress upon us that it is our high calling so to do. Brother Martin did not go in for scholarly speculations on God's unfathomable mysteries. What he believed and emphasized was that faith and love are the whole substance of a Christian. God's Son made himself of no reputation and took upon himself the form of a servant, empties himself of his glory and allowing us to show our love for him by loving our neighbor. Whatever kindliness, care, concern, thoughtfulness, and daily help we give to our brother and our sister, He considers this done for him. But we find it very difficult to love God in such a practical and a concrete way. There are people about us who are so deformed, we would like to shut our eyes to them or completely avoid them. I gave a series of services at one of the largest churches in the Seattle area. And there's a person in this church who has a vehicle, and he goes out and he collects some spastics and he brings them in their push carts. And he had pushed them up to the front of the church. And a spastic, you know, they're all over the place. They can't control many of their muscles. And their voluntary muscles. And I noticed that many people were very, very uncomfortable with the presence of these exceptional people. These special people are our brothers and our sisters, who according to God's will, yea, God's command, have a right to our love. In Bethel, Alex Funke, who is now the director and who is here this summer, says that the professors are the patients. They learn so much from them. I told you last night how Pastor Fritz, as busy as he was, he spent much time with the people in the house Patmos because they taught him so much. They taught him about enjoying little things. And in my memorable supper with Alex Funke, he told me many things. He also told you many things when he was here. There are two remarkable tapes in here from Alex Funke. And one of the things, a point he made in those lectures, is that you don't look down on them. And he told a story about one day when one of the professors of theology, and they have a theological seminary too at Bethel, among the many employees, of the 5,000 people that they have who work there, and he was out digging in his garden. And he was digging like he didn't know how to do it real well. And he didn't. And two of the patients, epileptics, came by and saw him. And so they went and talked to him and told him that, give us the shovel and the spade and the rakes and we'll do this and you go on back to being a professor of theology. And so they did a far better job than they did in a probably much less time, and they did a very good job of it. And he caught sight of them when they finished. And so he knew that they liked to smoke, so he went and got some cigars. And he ran out there and said, knowing that they'd probably take it, so he says, you've done a very fine job here, and you must have a cigar. And they refused the cigars. He couldn't understand that, and they said, Herr Professor, if on next Sunday you give a good sermon, and after you have given this good sermon, we come up to you and give you a cigar for your good sermon, what would you think? Well, I hope you get the point. Oh, he said, what I have not... Well, I hope you get the point. But in this supper with Alex Funky, he explained to me his calling, what the calling of Betel is. During this very remarkable discussion, the high point of it for me was when he said that if we here can show every patient who comes here through these doors, now numbers that exceed 5,000, if we can show them and convince them that God loves them, that is enough. And that is our mission. Now, I was tempted when I was at House Ebenezer. I told you last night that I was upstairs looking at the cubicles where these patients lived, about the celebration they were going to have for this person who had these toy cars, and the lovely cabinet they'd made for him. And just as we came from the upstairs to go down a long stairway outside of the dining hall, I caught sight of a number of the patients who were out there in their wheelchairs. And there was one who was on a cot. He was a spastic. And it's one of these who you saw him at that distance. You would probably turn right. Because they grimace when they talk and they're all over the place. As was Ricard. But he caught sight of us. And he wanted to know where I was from. I was from the United States. He was very excited at this. And then he found out I was a veterinarian, and he was even more excited. Only people usually are excited about that who want their children to get into veterinary school. He didn't. He was excited about it, and he asked a whole series of questions. It didn't come real fast. I don't know that much German, but I understood some of it, but some of it was very difficult for him as he ground his teeth, and it was very difficult to look at. Do you ever work on birds? What kind of birds do you work on? Are you ever able to make them fly again if they break their wings? How do you give therapy to fish? I answered all these questions as best I could. He said that he had asked these questions because he had seen something about this on television. And that brings me to a point. I said that he was laying flat on his back on his cot. And that's how he was for the first 50 years of his life. And then some students from this country came over. And they became very interested in many of the patients, but they became very interested in Rickard. And they worked with Rickard, and they worked and worked and worked with Rickard. And finally, they worked with him so long that he was then able to sit up just a little bit. And it makes it easier to watch television. He has a strap from this arm down to this leg. His final question to me was, do you employ any Indians in your veterinary college? I sort of wondered about that question. I told him that I did. I told him how many. But as I walked away with Fredheim Hoki, who was my escort, I said, you know, that was an unusual question he asked me. Was he interested in the number of Native Americans who work in my veterinary college, in our veterinary college, or in Indians from India? Oh, he said, he was interested in the Indians from India because he is very interested in India. You must realize that he supports a little child in India. I said, how in the world does he support a little child in India? Oh, he said, what I have not told you is that he has control of one foot. And he paints very beautiful pictures. And we frame these pictures and we sell them. And all the money goes to support this little child in India. I have asked them for a picture of Rickard. I'm going to hang it in my office. And it's to remind me that when I got problems, I really haven't got problems. And it'll also be useful to all of those who come to see me who have many problems. But the story doesn't end there. Because Rickard wouldn't be here supporting a little child in India today had not Bodelschwingh been successful in keeping Hitler from polishing off all of the patients at Bethel. For Hitler did put out the order, you know. He called it Leben sunt wertes Leben, life not worth preserving. And the forms were sent out to all of these places, including Beto. They must fill them out on all the patients. Bodelschwingh was sly as a serpent. He knew what was going on. He was following the lists of the obituary columns in other places, and he noticed they were getting longer. And he knew that was going to happen there. And he was gray. He was very discouraged in spirit, as those of you who know from reading Edna Hong's remarkable book, Bright Valley of Love. Now Gunther was outside his window every day praying and brought his friend the day that Dr. Brandt came. Dr. Brandt was Hitler's personal physician. For up to this point, Pastor Fritz Bodelschwingh had gone, tried to seek out anyone who might change the order or get a release from it. He refused to sign to fill out these forms, but they sent in a team of physicians who filled them out on all the patients. He went as far as contacting Hermann Göring, who gave him a letter that was not very helpful. He sought out the physicians in the high command. And then Dr. Brandt, who, as I said, was Hitler's personal physician, came with a bunch of people to make the arrangements. Pastor Fritz got him off to the side, and in their discussions, they came to the point of what is life not worth preserving? What determines humanity? It is their ability to communicate. And so Bodelschwingh took him to their worst cases in House Patmos. And I don't know all of those that he showed him. He could have showed him Margarita, who was hydrocephalic, epileptic, retarded, who was asleep when they arrived. He went over and stroked her on the head, called her by name. She turned over, saw Bodelschwingh. Big smile. He might have gone to Adolf, who I told you about last night, who probably knew only a few things, food, colors, and certainly Bodelschwink. And after he had showed him these, he turned to Dr. Brandt and he said, "Perhaps you cannot communicate with these people, but obviously I can. We can communicate with them." So Dr. Brandt called off the negotiations, and no one at Bethel was taken. That would not have happened, of course, if they had not taken time to communicate with these exceptional children. As a postscript, I should point out that at the Nuremberg trials, of course, Dr. Brandt was tried for his complicity with the crimes of the Third Reich and was put to death. But in this trial, he did make the comment to the effect that probably one of the most remarkable persons he ever met was Pastor Fritz Bodelschwink. This brings me to an incident that made a great impression upon me. It happened at a regional convention of the LCA in Portland, where I had discussed the subjects of rejection, which is the worst thing that can happen to a person, and when nobody's becomes somebody's. And in the course of this conversation, I told them that about our daughter Becky, who was blessed with a great concern and compassion for the unfortunate. She pursued diligently her studies and went into special education. And she ended up in Brainerd, Minnesota, working at a state hospital and taught to severely mentally retarded that came there. And one day, I told you about it at an earlier time to some of you, I was flying, I guess, from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, back home, and I wanted to go to Brainerd. And you've got to really want to go to Brainerd to go to Brainerd. You end up in the last leg on a Ford Tri-Motor. And it was dark when I arrived. Becky met me at plane. Before we went to dinner, she wanted to show me her charges. And so I went there. It was Saturday night. And as we entered this room, the little children, these exceptional children of God, were being put to bed. They're tucked in. And when Becky appeared, I thought, as I looked at the children, that Santa Claus had come. It was obvious that they loved her very much, and she loved them very much. And then we went from bed to bed, and she told me about each child. She tickled some, talked to all of them. Many of them, of course, could not understand articulation as we know it. As we walked away from this, she told that some of these children are never visited by their family. Only she and a few others are the ones, only ones that stand between them and utter rejection. And I told this story at this convention. And after I finished, obviously a professional man came up to me in Portland, Oregon, and he thanked me for this message. And he said, "I'm going to get off my son's back." He says, "I have a son who is unusually gifted. He could have done anything he wanted to. He was a great scholar, a great athlete, and the world was before him." And he said, "You know where he is?" Of course, I didn't. He said, "He's in Salem, Oregon. He's down there taking care and changing diapers on little children and bigger children, many of them who do not know their right hand from their left." And he says, "I've been after him all these years to do something that's important. And I'm never going to say anything to him again. Because you see, where his son stands and where Becky stood at that time was between some of God's most exceptional children and utter rejection. And I believe that that is a very important place to stand. Another constituent of the calling has to do with thankfulness for the many gifts bestowed upon us. But just saying thank you is not enough. We must do more than utter pretty phrases. It is better that we do not thank God at all if we are not ready to follow through on our words will only be mockery if our deeds do not speak eloquently of our gratitude. We thank God with our whole life. We must be in ceaseless search to find ways and means to thank him. Then our words of praise will join our works of love to become a ceaseless symphony in praise and thanksgiving to him who has given us all good things. And there's another point I think that I should make here rather to exceptional children. Because many of you will get into arguments in the future as to when is a life worth keeping. Many people are making these decisions today. In one of the places in Bethel, there is Hilda. She is in the same house where Edna Hong's daughter has been working. Now Hilda is severely retarded. She can't get up from her bed. Many people on seeing her will say, you know, that's nothing. It's nothing. But Hilda has beautiful big blue eyes. And one day the house mother in this house got a letter from Hilda's father. And he said he prays every day that God will take Hilda. The house mother wrote him and said, you must not pray that God will take Hilda. For in this house we have many epileptics, and the place gets to be pretty violent at times. And they're throwing things all over, and they're screaming, and it's terrible sometimes. And sometimes we can't control some of these children. And the only way we can control them is to take them over to Hilda. And when she looks at them with those great big blue eyes, it's the only thing that will settle them down. Our religion, our Christianity must reach our hands. If our faith stirs only our emotions and tantalizes our mind, it's sterile. It must alter our life if it is to be real. We must be about the Master's business. Our hands must be active in deeds of mercy and in works of justice. Jesus, I note, made evaluations on the basis of what people had done. In his own case, you may recall, when John the Baptist was in prison and heard what Jesus was doing, he sent two of his disciples to him who asked him, are you the one that should come, or do we look for another? And Jesus answered. He didn't say, you know, saying, here's all the things I'm telling people. He said, go tell them what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the good news preached to them. In Matthew 25, he said, I was hungry, and you, he didn't say you gave me comforting words. He says you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was naked, and you clothed me. Whatever you did for the humblest of my brothers and my sisters, you did for me. To serve God is to serve those in need. Remove the mask from the one in need, and you find God. In this mysterious company of believers, we join thousands of hands, many millions of hands, in loving service of one another and in the world, in our families, in our congregations, and in the communities and the world in which we live together for one another. To give even stronger emphasis to this point on how we should respond to the calling, I remind you that the famous Swiss psychologist, Dr. Jung, once stated that the questions he was most frequently asked were, what is life? Where am I going? Why am I here? When you and I as Christians understand the true meaning of the call and then show that there is power available from God to live an effective and meaningful life, no matter what this place in society is, when you and I show what it means to put Jesus first, we answer these questions not with a word or two or even several sentences, but we answer them with a life. I close with two quotations. The first is from The Little Prince, where the author captures a great truth in simple words. Here is my free secret, said the fox to the little prince, a very simple secret. It is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. And then this closing story from the late Lorne Eisley, a story that I've told to some of you before, but is appropriate here, who in his book, The Unexpected Universe, paints a haunting picture of a star thrower. It is a picture that I shall never forget, and I hope none of you do either. He tells about one day when he walked along the beach at Costabel, a beach littered with many forms of life, many dying forms, and it seemed to Eisley that the sea was rejecting its offspring. These life forms would fight their way out to sea only to be cast again, rejected upon the shore. Among these were starfish that lay shrinking in the hot sun. And as he walked along, Eisley came upon a stranger leaning over one of these starfishes. And he asked him, is it alive? Yes, said the stranger. And with a gentle but firm grip on the starfish, he spun it far out into the sea with these words, it may live again if the offshore pull is strong enough. And so then the stranger went along, and at first Lorne Eisley thought the man crazy. But he, too, later went along picking up rejected dying starfish and throwing them out into the sea again in hopes that they would live again. Commenting on this event, Eisley wrote, somewhere there is a hurler of stars. I have told you this to remind you that we must all become more avid hurlers of stars, giving others another chance at life. I have told you this because if we were not here to help our fellow men and women and their animals, there is probably no good reason for us to be here at all. Remove the mask from the one in need, and you find God. Hail to you, star throwers. Amen.